This is one of the smaller rooms. So what I want to talk about is something that originally occurred almost 40 years ago when Stephen Hawking came up with the quote-unquote derivation, and we'll see that that had some problems to it, that black holes, instead of being black, actually radiate with a thermal character and eventually, presumably, will evaporate. The problem, of course, is that that was a theoretical calculation in an area where you're combining quantum mechanics and gravity, and as we know, we don't have a theory that really combines quantum mechanics and gravity. The last time we had that problem, we were in the turn of the 20th century, we were at least guided by lots of experiments. What I want to do is to, at the end of this talk, is to talk a little bit about the first experiment that has now been done, which gives indications that the horizons of black holes really do emit thermal radiation with a temperature like that given by Stephen Hawking. I, of course, won't be hauling a little black hole out of my back pocket. It would fall out anyway. To show you it radiating, so it's going to be a somewhat more indirect kind of an experiment. So let's remind ourselves. All right, how do I do this one? I think there's something called the iris here. There we go. It's like playing an organ. If you know, you press the bass pedal and you always have to press it about 3 seconds before the note is going to sound because it takes that long for the huge organ pipes to start sounding. And this is sort of somewhat similar. Anyway, so what Stephen did was to look at quantum field theory in curved space-time. In this case, the space-time is supposed to be a classical general relativistic space-time describing a black hole, or in his case, the formation of a black hole by the collapse of some matter. And on top of this, placing a field, in his case, a scalar field, the simplest one that you can get, and looking at the quantum mechanics of that field in the presence of this black hole. And very surprising, what you would expect is that as that star collapses, it's going to produce radiation, and that will then just settle down and disappear rather rapidly, and you would have just the black hole sitting there. Instead, what he found was that this black hole just kept radiating. And furthermore, it kept radiating with a temperature inversely proportional to the mass of the black hole. For a solar mass black hole, that's about 10 to the minus 5 Kelvin. Wavelengths of a few kilometers are the dominant thermal wavelengths, as you would expect, because the size of the black hole is a few kilometers in size. And this radiation just, at least according to the theory, just keeps going on forever. Now, since the temperature is proportional to the mass, and the mass, as we know from E equals mc squared, is just the energy, the temperature is therefore a function of the energy, one can use ordinary thermodynamic arguments to derive that this system maybe should have an entropy. Just from this equation, we can integrate it up, and you find that the entropy is 1/4 of the surface area of the black hole, measured in Planck sizes. That's around an area of 10 to the minus 70 meters squared. So since the surface area of a solar mass black hole is of the order of a few kilometers squared, that's a huge, huge entropy. Now, Christodoulou and Hawking had already shown that there's a quantity associated with black holes, namely the area of the black hole, which is just what this seems to be suggesting, which always increases, at least as long as the energy that flows into it is positive energy, not negative energy. And it's hard, it's not impossible, but it's hard to find negative energy. So this all seemed to fit together into a nice, making black holes behave as though they were some sort of thermodynamic object. But if we look at Stephen's derivation, we realize that there's a problem in it. This is supposed to be a black hole. So the green stuff down at the bottom, have speakers ever taken a swing at the screen? This green stuff, well, that's supposed to be green. The camera seems to have some problems in color rendition. This is supposed to be the collapsing matter. This is supposed to be the radius. The radius in this case measuring simply the square root of the surface area. This line here is supposed to represent the horizon, this black line. Namely, that's the last light ray that can escape from the center of the object. This point here is supposed to be r equals zero, and time runs up this way. The last light ray that comes out, and then it gets stuck at this constant radius r and never gets farther away from the center than that. Any light ray that was emitted a little bit earlier eventually peels off and goes off to infinity. Any light ray emitted a little bit later crashes into the singularity in the center of this black hole. Now, if we look at the radiation that's given off here with this frequency omega, which is whose wavelength is about the same as the mass or the radius of the black hole, and we ask, where did that come from? As we trace that backwards, we find that it can't have come from inside the black hole. Because if it had come from inside the black hole, something escaped from outside the black hole. It gets squeezed up against the horizon exponentially much, and it keeps getting squeezed against the horizon until finally it goes through r equals zero. It looks as though it's being reflected here. It's actually just going through r equals zero because I'm just plotting positive r's. And it comes out here with a frequency of e to the t over m. M is the measure in this case of how long it takes light to travel across a distance the size of a black hole. T is the time after the collapse of the matter times that initial frequency omega. Now, for a solar mass black hole, M is about 10 to the minus 6 seconds. And so if you look 1 second after the black hole is formed, this is a factor of e to the 10 to the 6th. That's an immensely huge number. It's a number that I don't even have to tell you what units I'm measuring it in, because any units you can imagine are going to give the same e to the 10 to the 6th. Whether it's masses of the universe or Planck frequencies, it doesn't matter. That's still e to the 10 to the 6th. That's a humongous frequency. H bar times that is e to the 10 to the 6th times the mass of the whole universe. Do I believe the quantum field theory that was used to derive this system with those kinds of energies and frequencies? The answer is, of course, no. It's just absurd. We've gotten into a region in which we know that the theory has fallen apart and just presumably gives us nonsense. So as I like to say, if some graduate student of Stevens had come up to him with a suggestion, I suspect he would have told him to go away and do a bit of physics instead of engaging in this kind of stupid speculation. Fortunately, the graduate student was him. One always likes one's own theories better. But the consequences of this, in a sense, were far too nice to just throw away. One of them is that these black holes behave like thermodynamic objects. They really are statistical mechanical objects. One can build heat machines and so forth to extract work and energy from the heat that's given off by a black hole. It's led to all kinds of employment for physicists. People have now been arguing for the last 30 years about whether there's a thing called the information paradox, and that relates to whether or not the entropy of a black hole is in some sense fundamental, or is just like any other entropy. Boltzmann taught us that the entropy of ordinary objects was just k times the log of the number of states, of the microstates, consistent with the macroscopic system. Is the entropy of a black hole like this, or is it more fundamental? Well, I don't want to get into that. What I want to do is to attack that central question: is this derivation just complete nonsense, or is there some sense to it? Of course, if one could do experiments and one could see black holes evaporating, that would short-circuit all of those discussions. Because if we saw them evaporate, we'd know we're on the right track, and if we didn't see them evaporate, we'd know we weren't. Unfortunately, as I've said, our chances of running across a small black hole are negligible. The big black hole at the center of the galaxy has a temperature of about 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin, and since the surrounding universe has a temperature of about 3 Kelvin, it's really hard to see the radiation from that black hole. Even smaller black holes, a solar mass black hole, is 10 to the minus 6. Back in 1972, I was asked to give a colloquium at Oxford, and it was supposed to be on black holes, and I was trying to figure out a way of getting across the idea of what a black hole was like, and I came across this idea that I've since called dumb holes, not because they're stupid, but because of deaf and dumb. Something that's dumb is something that's unable to speak. Where we've got this waterfall, and that waterfall goes faster than the velocity of sound at this point. Now here's a little graduate student fish that's fallen over the waterfall. He yelled for help out here. Well, we know out here the velocity of the water is less than the velocity of sound, so some of that sound will slowly climb up and eventually get to a supervisor. Not that the supervisor will be able to do anything, but he will at least know what happened to a student. However, if he yells after he passes that surface, the sound is swept over the waterfall faster than it can climb out, and it never gets out. This surface acts just like the horizon of a black hole. And in fact, many of the features of a black hole horizon are in fact mimicked by this kind of a system. What I discovered when I was teaching in 1980 a course in fluid mechanics, you know, as you do, you're trying to prepare your lectures and your mind wanders. And I went back to that little model, and I suddenly realized that it was far better than I thought, that in fact, if you look at the equations of motion of the sound waves in that fluid flow, you find that the equations are exactly the same as the equations for a scalar field around a black hole. Furthermore, you can go through Hawking's derivation step by step and get the result that this system should also emit thermal radiation. The temperature in this case is not proportional to the inverse mass. What would the mass be? But in this case, it's proportional to the rate of change. C is the velocity of sound. V is the velocity of the fluid. It's basically proportional to the rate of change of this quantity as you go across the horizon. In this case, we note that T doesn't depend on the energy that went into forming the system, so you can't make the thermodynamic argument. So this little model tells us nothing about this whole thermodynamics in black holes, but it can give one a clue as to what's going on in that argument that Stephen gave. R is the distance along... Sorry, I should have... R is the distance that you're traveling along the waterfall, so it would just be the distance along here. H-bar is Planck's constant, K is Boltzmann's constant, C is the velocity of sound instead of the velocity of light in this case, V is the velocity of the fluid, and 4 pi is usually 1. At least the way in which I do calculations. Pardon?
Because you're saying it's the d by dr of c squared minus v squared?
Increase. It's not negative.
Okay. Should be the other sign then. I mean, r is...
I think that r in that case is the radial coordinate out rather than going in. Yes. Sorry. You get exactly the same exponential frequency problem here, however. And clearly, for sound waves, that's nonsense. You can't have frequencies of e to the 10 to the 5th of sound waves. The wavelength would be far, far shorter than the distance between the atoms. So what happens in this case? Instead, we know with these sound waves, you get a dispersion relationship, the relationship between the frequency of the wave and the inverse wavelength, the wave number. That's just 2 pi over lambda. That relationship between omega and k is not a straight line, as it is in special relativity, but it's in general going to curve. If you look at very short wavelength sound waves, they don't travel at the same speed. They don't have the same frequency as they do at very long wavelengths. So what happens to these waves if we go through that same procedure we had before? We have this long wavelength wave up here, which is that thermal radiation that comes out. We trace it backwards. It gets squeezed up against the horizon just as before, but eventually its wavelength becomes so short that it enters this region of the dispersion relationship, where the group velocity, which is just the slope, is less, i.e., it's less than the velocity of the fluid. As I go back in time, that short wavelength wave packet, therefore, must have come from outside the horizon and been swept in. It's trying to travel outwards, but it's swept in via the velocity of the fluid until it gets near the horizon. It gets longer and longer in wavelength and eventually escapes as this thermal radiation. So one of the questions is, given that, do you still get a temperature? And the answer is yes. I did numerous numerical experiments, not theoretical ones, which showed that you still seem to get the temperature as you would have expected beforehand. Furthermore, that temperature is basically the temperature of the last horizon that the wave packet sees. For example, let's say we've got a dispersion relationship that looks like this. Here we've got a linear relationship between omega and k. Here we've got a different linear relationship between omega and k. This will be a horizon as far as the waves of that wavelength are concerned. This will be a horizon as far as those wavelengths are concerned. Which of the temperatures corresponding to these two horizons will be the one that determines the temperature that's produced? So if we look at this diagram, in the past we have this high frequency wave that comes in. It's trying to escape, but it's being swept in by the fluid, comes near the horizon, becomes a longer and longer wavelength. Eventually, its wavelength gets long enough that it enters this regime. It now gets swept in again towards the this other horizon and escapes. The answer is it's this last low-frequency horizon. And what that suggests very strongly is that this whole process of the production of the radiation is something that's a low-frequency phenomenon. Although the derivation, as Hawking had it and as this has it, seems to rely on very high frequencies, that seems not to be where the physics is. The physics all seems to come from very, very low frequency, i.e. the temperature is determined by that last horizon that the particle sees. Particle creation is a low-frequency, long-wavelength process, not some sort of near horizon Planck scale kind of process. Yes?
So if in quantum gravity does something to modify the dispersion relations, it would not, at Planck scales, it would not affect the
right.
prediction of quantum radiation.
Right. So there's no subtle structure around the horizon that determines the radiation. Let's look at the two different ways in which one can calculate how many particles are created. The one way is that we have a wave packet here in the past, a high-frequency wave packet. For a scalar wave equation, it turns out that there's two kinds of solutions. One of them have a positive norm. The others have negative norm. There's this norm that you can define for the scalar field equation, which can have either of two signs, either positive norm or negative norm. And it's the creation of negative norm stuff out of positive norm that is the indication that you've got particle creation. So here you start off with a positive norm packet. It comes into the horizon. Part of it goes inside the horizon, and it has negative norm. Part of it comes out and escapes to infinity. It has positive norm. And as we'll see later on, it's that relationship between the negative norm and the positive norm that gives you that measures the temperature. One can also do the calculation backwards, where you have this wave packet at the final stage. You propagate it backwards in time against the horizon. It gets squeezed up, and when it comes out here, it's a mixture of positive and negative norm. Those two calculations are entirely equivalent. This calculation is actually, if I run time backwards, simply the calculation of what would happen if one had a white hole. A white hole is something out of which stuff can come, but nothing can go into it. In this case, this wave packet travels towards the white hole horizon, gets squeezed up against the horizon, and then eventually escapes out here in this positive and negative norm packet. This is going to be important for the experiment that we do later on, because our experiment has to do with the white hole horizons rather than the black hole horizons. So the conclusion that we've come to is that Hawking's derivation is nonsense. It really isn't right. There's no, I mean, mathematically it's fine. You know, he didn't slip up on some sign error, as I am wont to do whenever I do a calculation. But when you look at the physics, it's really nonsense. But is it right? It's one of the lessons that was very hard to learn in physics, is that even though the arguments can be wrong, the answers that you come out with at the end can be right. So, what? No, exactly. Most of the time, if you do nonsense in the derivation, what you get at the end is nonsense as well. You have to have really good intuition in order to be able to do the other. So one of the questions is, can we run experiments? Since we can't find small black holes, perhaps we can do an experiment. And in particular, the experiment that I want to look at is the following. What I have is some water flowing over an underwater obstacle. So the water has to flow faster here than it does out here. In the previous discussion of dumb holes, I was looking at the velocity of sound in the water. In this case, I'm going to be looking at the velocity of these surface waves on the water instead. So these are what are called gravity waves. They're not gravitational radiation. They're waves whose restoring force is basically provided by the gravitational field of the Earth. These gravity waves travel along the surface of the water, And if the water is going fast enough at this point, we get a horizon here, which is basically a white hole horizon. These waves come, and then they get squeezed up against this horizon and build up there. If you go out to the outlet of a river, go like to the Don, is it Don River flowing into the, is the river still there? The valley is there, but I don't know if the river is still there. If you look at the outflow for rivers and you watch the waves come in, you find the waves come in and start piling up, becoming shorter and shorter wavelength because they're running into a horizon near the outflow of the river. So what we want to do is to look at the wave equation for these gravity waves. Boy, this thing really doesn't like the color green. That's green. That's the first time I've ever seen a projector which is colorblind. Anyway, if we have a constant depth of water, flowing water, for example, and here's a little disturbance on the surface of the water, and we're going to assume that the water is divergence-free, that basically says that the velocity of sound in the water is far higher than any velocities we're concerned with. We're assuming that the water is incompressible. Real water, of course, isn't incompressible, but the velocity of sound in water at kilometers per second is far, far higher than any of the velocities, maximum of meters per second, that we're going to be looking at here, so we can neglect it. Similarly, we're going to assume that the water is irrotational, namely that the curl of the velocity is equal to zero. And we can then write the velocity as the gradient of some potential psi. Along the bottom, we know that the velocity has to be parallel to the bottom of the water. At the top, since there's nothing above it, we're going to neglect the atmospheric pressure. The pressure has to be equal to zero. So all we have are these boundary conditions at the top and the bottom for the water. And inside the water, the velocity of the water obeys these very simple equations. In fact, we notice if we plug this into this equation that phi simply obeys grad squared phi equals zero. So all of the interesting physics comes from boundary conditions rather than from equations of motion. The Euler-Lagrange equations for the flow of the water look like this, which then can be cast into the Bernoulli form, which looks like this. If we now look for small fluctuations of that water, that's too messy. Okay. If we look at small fluctuations of the water, what we find is that the relationship between the frequency and the wave number has this rather complicated form. Y0 is the depth of the water, K is the wave number. At small wave numbers, tanh of K times Y0 is just K times Y0. So in that case, omega is just proportional to K. Those are called shallow water waves. In that case, the phase velocity, which is omega over k, is just the square root of g times h. And the group velocity is similarly just the square root of g times h. If this term is much bigger than 1, tanh is equal to 1, and the relationship between omega and k is now a square root relationship, in which case the phase velocity turns out to be twice the group velocity. We'll get there. Two talks got interpolated. Okay. Sorry about that. This is all stuff that I've already said. It turns out, in fact, that one can find one of the problems is that that derivation I gave you was a derivation in which the bottom was just a nice flat bottom. What happens if we curve the bottom, as we want to do in our experiment? Very surprisingly, I discovered that this, in a sense, can be solved, quote-unquote, exactly, or at least one can find the equations of motion exactly, if one has just two-dimensional flow. In other words, one doesn't worry about any flows into or out of the blackboard. If one does that, then we can define a new vector, which is just the perpendicular to the velocity vector. It turns out also to be divergence and curl-free, so I can write it as the gradient of a potential. And if I now use these two potentials, phi and psi, as my coordinates, instead of using x and y as my coordinates, it turns out that the equation of motion for those surface waves can be derived from a Lagrangian. Given how complicated it could have been, a very simple Lagrangian. Up here we have what's just the convective derivative of the fluctuations of the potential psi away from the background flow. And down here we've got again that kind of tangent relationship that we found for uniform water flow. So the equations of motion in this coordinate system look almost the same as the equations of motion did for water in a on a uniform bottom. It's just that these coordinates are rather strange coordinates. Phi sub t here is basically the amount of water that is flowing along the system. It's the value of the phi coordinate, the difference in the value of the phi coordinate between the bottom of the tank and the top of the tank. V squared is the background flow, the square of the background flow of the velocity, and delta psi is the fluctuations of the velocity potential just at the surface of the water. Everything here is evaluated purely at the surface of the surface of the water. Capital G here turns out to be effectively the gravitational field, which is composed of two parts. One of them is the part that's due to ordinary gravity. That's little g is just the usual little g of ordinary gravity, and the other part is the phi derivative of V squared, which is basically the centrifugal force. So if the water has, the top of the water has some curvature, that's going to decrease the effect, you know, curvature like this, the water flowing up and over, that effectively is going to decrease the effective gravitational field that these waves see on the surface of the water. So that equation turns out to be quite simple, which is fortunate. So what we have now is a model system in which we can try and test stuff. Of course, trying to see quantum mechanics in this system is going to be really, really hard. If I make an estimate of what is the rate of change of velocity for that fluid as it comes off of that shelf to estimate what the temperature is, I get a temperature of about 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin. Now, seeing a temperature of 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin in water is a little bit difficult. At least the water we have in Vancouver tends to freeze before you get to that temperature. So what can you do? Fortunately, what we're looking at here is a linear system. And for a linear system, the quantum mechanics of a linear system is particularly simple. harmonic oscillator is an example of a linear system. But for a linear system, for example, I can take the I'm taking only one mode, one degree of freedom. So let's take call the components of that one degree of freedom x and its conjugal momentum p. The fundamental thing we know from quantum mechanics is this commutation relationship between x and p. Now we can define an operator A, which is something times x plus I times the inverse of that something times p. This guy is what's often called an annihilation operator in some very particular circumstances. But you notice here that I haven't looked at all at the energy of the system. This is true in general. I can define this set of operators, and I can define it for arbitrary values of theta. And those two operators, this operator and its Hermitian conjugate, will obey the commutation relationship that A times A dagger commutator is equal to 1, which are exactly the commutation relationships of the annihilation and creation operators. I can furthermore define a state, which is often called the vacuum state for this annihilation operator, as the state that's destroyed by this operator. If I have an energy that looks like this, this looks like the harmonic oscillator, and I choose e to the theta to be the square root of k times m, then these A's are exactly the annihilation operators, and this vacuum state is the minimum energy state. But I don't have to choose the A's and A daggers that way. These A and A daggers, if one solves the equations of motion for the system, correspond to the positive and negative norm parts of the harmonic oscillator. Now, for this system, I can define something called a two-mode squeeze state. Let's regard A and B are two different systems, and they're going to be my input. And C and D are the annihilation operators of my output. In particular, I'm going to choose the dynamics of the system in such a way that the output is related to the input via this kind of a relationship. Namely, it's a mixture of C, the annihilation output annihilation operator, is a mixture of the annihilation operator of A and the creation operator of B. In order that that work out, it turns out that I have to multiply. I have coefficients here, and those coefficients have to be such that the square of this minus the square of that has to be equal to 1. And so I've just called that cosh and sinh because I know cosh squared minus sinh squared equals 1. Similarly, for D, I need exactly the same cosh and sinh made up of the annihilation operator for B and the creation operator for A. So if we assume an initial state as the vacuum state for A and B, what does that mean as far as C and D are concerned? What I find is that the vacuum state for A and B, expressed in terms of the vacuum state for the CD operators, is a multi-particle system. In other words, it's this state hit by a whole bunch of creation operators for the C and D, and they always come in pairs. So this state can be written as a bunch of pairs of C and D type particles in there. Now, why am I doing this? First thing is if I look at, for example, I trace out, I look at the density matrix for the C operator, I get rid of the D operator, I only look at things having to do with the C particle, then I find that that density matrix is a thermal density matrix. You automatically get temperature coming out of it. Well, all you get is this ratio of omega divided by kT, which turns out to be the logarithm of this Tanch function. So in terms of the C and D vacuum, the A and B vacuum is a two-mode squeeze state, and it's a thermal state as far as C is concerned. Furthermore, this is the generic model for an amplifier. If, for example, we start off with the A coming in not being zero, but being in what's called a coherent state, namely A times phi is equal to phi times phi, and B times phi is equal to zero, so it's a vacuum state for B, but for A, it's there's some field coming in. Then if I look at the C operator, I find that the C operator is cosh times that. In other words, the output in the C channel is cosh phi times cosh psi times the amplitude of the input channel. And this doesn't depend on what the phase is of this input channel. This can be a complex number. No matter what that complex number is, I just multiply it by the same amount. This is a generic model for a linear amplifier. The output is cosh times the input. However, as soon as we've done that, we can also look at the noise. For example, if we look at the expectation value of C plus C dagger, we get cosh that's amplified by an amount cosh, as we would expect. But the fluctuations in that are multiplied, the fluctuations squared in that are multiplied by cosh squared plus sinh squared. This we would sort of expect. That's just the amplification of the input noise gives us the output noise. But one also always gets some extra input noise coming out here. So an amplifier, a linear amplifier, always does two things. It amplifies the input noise and adds some extra noise. Now, why in the world am I taking this digression about amplifiers and so forth? Notice, incidentally, that this noise is completely determined by the amplification factor. Furthermore, if I know what the amplification factor is, I know what the quantum noise is. Okay? How can I measure the amplification factor? Well, I can just run an ordinary classical experiment on the system. Find out how much more input I get, output I get than what I've put in the input. That immediately tells us what the quantum noise should be. The important thing is that if one looks at Hawking's derivation, one finds that all he has done is shown that a black hole acts as a linear amplifier. The whole derivation of that, and for the dumb holes, is that the system acts as a linear amplifier. And any linear amplifier always has noise. That noise is just the Hawking radiation. And it has a thermal form. As I said, these linear amplifiers produce thermal type output noise. Given the classical behavior of the system, one completely determines that quantum noise. This was already recognized by Einstein in 1919 with his A and B coefficients. Haus and Müllen in about 54 also wrote a paper where they argued that any amplifier has to produce noise, any linear amplifier has to produce noise, going through an argument that was slightly different than this. So if one has a linear amplifier, one is going to get noise, and in this case, the noise is precisely the Hawking radiation. So let me get to the experiment, finally. White holes are the time inverse of black holes, exactly the same particle creation. It turns out in our experiment, it's far easier to do the white hole experiment than it is the black hole. But the answers are the same. Secondly, this system is a linear quantum system. And we know that the quantum behavior is completely determined by the classical behavior. So that means that I don't have to look for this 10 to the minus 12 degree temperature. I can do classical experiments. I can look at this amplifier and ask how much amplification is it doing, and that will tell me how much quantum stuff, noise it's going to produce, and in particular tell me how much Hawking radiation this system is going to produce. So that brings us to the experiment that we recently did at the University of British Columbia. Preliminary kinds of experiments like this were done by Germain Rousseau in Nice with a far, far larger tank than we had, which had the great disadvantage that it took him a day to do something that takes us about 5 minutes. And it turns out they also has advantages. They had much less dissipation in their system. But it turns out the advantage of being able to do things quickly when you don't know what you're doing far outweighs the other disadvantages. It's an international experiment. Silke Weinfurtner was there as a European Marie Curie fellow. Ted Tedford is a civil engineer. And so is Greg Lawrence. He's the professor. He was primarily the one that got us access to the tanks. These are tanks used by the undergraduate students to run experiments in civil engineering, and we more or less took it over for half a year. And they sort of shuffled off and used some of the other tanks to do their teaching with. Without that, we would never have been able to do the experiment. Matt Penrice is an undergraduate student, and Maurice Richards was a visiting graduate student from Brazil who was involved in the early stages of this experiment. And if I push the right button. Ah, yes. This is written up now in Archive 1008-1911 if you want to read about it. This is the experiment. It's a long flume. I keep wanting to call it a flume tank, but civil engineers look at me and say, what the world are you talking about? There's no tank in it. There's a pump here which pumps water from a reservoir. The water comes into here. There's a bunch of screens here to try and damp out any of the waves, etc., produced by the water flowing in here. The water then flows down this channel over this obstacle, a wing-shaped type obstacle. So it has to flow faster over the top of that obstacle. Eventually gets here and falls into this tank. There's a gate here that we can use to raise and lower the height of the water in the flume. Furthermore, there's a little motor here which can raise and lower the screen, which produces waves which travel back towards this obstacle in the flume. So this is our experiment. Here's an example of the dispersion relationship of those waves, the surface waves at some point in the tank. These are the waves that we send in. We sent in waves with frequency of between 0.02 hertz, i.e. 50 second period, and about 0.8 hertz. Those are wavelengths of from about 67 meters to about 1 meter. The total length of that flume, incidentally, is about 6 meters. So for the longest wavelengths, one wavelength doesn't fit into the tank. That generator is just producing, raising, and lowering the level of the water, basically, is all that you see of it. These waves have positive group velocity. The slope here is positive. And they have a positive phase velocity. Omega divided by k is positive. And it's more or less the same as the group velocity. These two waves, which have the same frequency, and since the background flow is constant, frequency is a conserved number, have the opposite group velocity, i.e., they travel, if these waves travel towards the obstacle, these waves travel away from the obstacle. This wave has positive phase velocity, omega over k, both of those are positive, so that's a positive phase velocity. This wave has negative phase velocity. these waves in this branch are the negative norm waves. And the creation of these guys is the indication, quantum mechanically, that one is getting particles being created. Under the thermal hypothesis, which is what Hawking argued, the ratio of the square of the amplitude here divided by the square of that amplitude should look like e to the minus omega over the temperature. Now, how do we measure these waves? Here's the water. We fill the water with a dye called rhodamine WT. Its main purpose is that when we shine this green laser light on it, it fluoresces. It fluoresces in the pink. What we have here is a laser. It's about a half a watt laser, green laser, that shines down onto the surface of the water. If we didn't have the dye in here, of course, that light would just either reflect straight off or come down and hit the bottom. You wouldn't be able to see anything from the side. And what we want to do is to take a picture from the side so we can figure out how high, what the height is of this water at every point along the tank. So we fill it up with this dye so that the green light gets absorbed within the top few millimeters of this stuff and gives us this very bright, narrow line here along the surface that we can photograph and therefore measure the height of the water. Here's an example of one of those photographs. We use a high-resolution camera, 2,000 by 1,000 pixels. So this goes from 500 to 550 pixels horizontally. So you can see the horizontal pixels here. Vertically, it's 85 to 77 pixels there. If we simply measured the brightest pixel, the center of the brightest pixel are these red lines. But we can, in fact, do much better than that by making use of the brightness of the adjacent pixels. And assuming that we've got just a nice parabolic brightness, which the defocusing of the camera more or less assures us that we do, we can calculate where the peak is of the brightness, and that lies along this line here. So what we can see, this is one pixel here, we see we can actually measure the height of the water to much better than a single pixel, to about somewhere between a fifth to a seventh of a pixel. What we did was we took a picture with no obstacle in there, simply flowing water. So all we're doing is measuring the noise. And what really surprised us was that we got this picture, and we realized that what we were seeing here in this picture was exactly the dispersion relationship. What the noise was on the surface of the tank was a bunch of little waves traveling along the surface of the tank. And we could measure them. The amplitudes of these are about somewhere between 0.1 to 0.2 millimeters. So we can see that we can measure the surface, we can measure the heights of these waves to about a tenth of a millimeter, and the noise in here is much better than a tenth of a millimeter. So that we're really getting very, very accurate measurements of the surface of the tank. What confused us for a long time was these. There seemed to be an extra branch in the dispersion relationship. And we wondered what in the world that was. And Ted Tedford was the one that suddenly pointed out to us, look, we're not just looking at waves that travel along the tank, but there can be modes, transverse modes. The first transverse mode has a node right in the middle where the laser is, so you wouldn't see that. This should be the second transverse mode. When you count, when you stick in the numbers, that's precisely what it is. Yes?
Wouldn't the back driving force be mainly surface tension?
So it would be no. These wavelengths are very long. These wavelengths are meters. So the height, the amplitude is tenths of millimeters. But the wavelength of these guys, even out here, the wavelength is 5 centimeters. So you're starting to get into the surface tension regime out here. But in here, you're way far away from the surface tension regime. surface tension isn't important.
What is the black curve?
The black curve is the waves traveling in the opposite direction. So we've got waves that travel against the flow, which is the red curve, and the black curve are the waves that are traveling with the flow. They, of course, are traveling much faster, which is why this has a much higher slope than this one does. Here's a little movie. In this case, we had a little wedge. We eventually replaced that by just a screen. And that produces these waves that travel along the tank, eventually running into this obstacle. And notice, just like with tsunami, as they come up to this obstacle, their wavelength decreases, and they build up an amplitude. So this is the obstacle. This is about a 5-degree slope here in this particular obstacle that we have. This is a space-time diagram. The colors represent the amplitude, blue positive and red negative, I believe. And so what we're seeing here are the phase crests. These are the crests of the waves that are traveling in. Notice that in this case, this wave packet, this is sort of the place where this is brightest, is like the wave packet is traveling in towards this obstacle. It hits the obstacle, and now the brightest part of it is actually being dragged out away from the obstacle. That's just the group velocity. So the group velocity was to the left over here, and then once the wavelength gets short enough, it gets dragged out to the right over here. Notice that the phase velocity still remains positive all the way through here. So this is a really nice example of the difference between phase and group velocity. Here you've got, you know, the maximum part of the wave is sitting in here, and the crests keep traveling across this little wave packet. If you watch it, you just see these little crests traveling towards the left, whereas the lump travels slowly off towards the right. And the crests keep traveling across and then disappearing at the back end of that little wave packet. And you watch this, you know, when you go watching the waves on the lake. There's this big, huge wave comes traveling in, and you think, oh boy, it's going to hit me, and suddenly it just disappears. Because the group velocity is much less than the phase velocity. This is from one of our experiments, and what this is the Fourier transform. This is the temporal Fourier transform, so this is the frequency, and this is the spatial Fourier transform. In this case, we've taken a slightly different coordinate system so that actually the horizontal distance is also measured in seconds. So the wave number is actually in hertz. But the important thing to notice about this system is first that we're getting both positive phase velocity and negative phase velocity. We are creating these negative norm waves. Secondly, is that one of the things that we did was to choose the period of observation to be an exact multiple of the period of the waves. As you know, when you take the Fourier transform of a partial sine wave, you get a very broad spectrum unless you choose those two frequencies to be exactly the same. As we notice, everything is dark here, and it's bright there. So we really have chosen the frequencies well. The time period of observation is an exact multiple of the period of the waves that we've sent in. So here are four examples. The green line was 50-second period, 0.02 hertz wave traveling in. And we notice that we get this strong incoming wave coming in here. So this is the Fourier transform. That's the Fourier transform of this frequency, temporal frequency band right here. So getting rid of everything else and just looking at that band. There's the incoming wave. It's got some broad shoulders because it turns out that the incoming wave does not, the frequency, the spatial frequency doesn't fit. As we know, it's 60 meters long, and we're only taking a picture of 2 meters worth of it. But here you see the negative and the positive norm and the negative norm stuff coming out. They have basically the same amplitude, which is what you'd expect for very low frequencies. As the frequency goes up, one of the things we notice is that the peak moves in for these guys and moves out for these guys. If we look back at the dispersion relationship, that's exactly what you'd expect. As the frequency goes up, these guys move in and these guys move out. Now, this incidentally is the noise. This was taken. This is the amplitude looking at this frequency band here, i.e. for the Fourier transform that's right next to this guy. And we notice that the amplitude of the noise is really very small. It's a factor of at least 10 to 100 times less than the signal. This corresponds to the blue curve, and that's the noise in the adjacent band. So this system really is got very little noise. What I've done here is I've taken only this part of the peak and plotted a space-time diagram, done the inverse Fourier transform for that, and notice that we get these very, very strong positive being in this direction, positive phase velocity. These are the positive norm waves. And these are the negative norm waves. Notice that they've got exactly the opposite phase velocity. And they're strong. We can see them. This is the final key transparency. So we ran this for 9 different frequencies. And we calculated the amplitude of the negative norm squared divided by the positive norm squared part of that wave. The thermal hypothesis says that that ratio of those amplitudes should go as e to the minus frequency divided by something. This is a plot of the log. This is the natural log of that ratio versus the frequency. It's a straight line to within experimental accuracy. The fit, this is about 8. That corresponds to a frequency of about 0.125 hertz. So the characteristic frequency of this logarithmic plot is about 0.125 hertz, and that corresponds to a temperature of about 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin. So what we've shown here is that this system does produce thermal radiation. And if we use the fact that once we know what the classical behavior is of an amplifier, we know what its quantum behavior is. If one were really to look for the quantum frequency, this system would produce radiation with a temperature of 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin, quantum radiation. So this is effectively the first measurement that anybody has ever made of the quantum radiation from a horizon that Stephen Hawking predicted now almost 40 years ago. I better quit at this point and leave it open for questions.
You've learned lots of stuff today.
In the derivation of your Lagrangian, you assume no velocity profile in and out of the blackboard, right?
Yes.
But your system looked as if the cross section of the flow was like square almost. So the boundary conditions weren't far enough for that to happen. And maybe that's why you got those modes.
Well, those the first thing is that those transverse modes are almost certainly there because of vibrations of the walls, etc., setting up transverse vibrations in the system as well. It would, of course, be nice to have a much wider tank, etc. We're operating right in the middle of the tank. So in the middle of the tank, you would expect to find that the Z component of the derivative is equal to zero. Okay. Look, there's all kinds of things in which this system differs from that sort of derivation that I gave. The derivation assumed irrotational flow. We took pictures of the flow. In other words, we put tiny little beads of basically nylon, which had the same density as water does, and then you illuminate it with a couple of laser flashes to measure the velocity flow. And on the lee side of that obstacle, you find that the flow is not irrotational. Okay, it's slower at the bottom. It doesn't stagnate at the bottom, but there's a slower region at the bottom of the flow than there is over the top, which you'd expect. I mean, the Reynolds number of this system is something like 5,000 or something like that. So you definitely expect vorticity to play a role. This system also has lots of, you know, water has lots of damping, viscosity. You know, we'd love to do this with liquid helium. I don't know where we would get, you know, multi-gallons of liquid helium, and number one, and number two, how in the world would you photograph the surface? Because dyes don't dissolve very well in liquid helium, and the refractive index of liquid helium is sort of almost the same as that of vacuum, so it's really hard to figure out where the surface is. Never mind the fact that I don't think the Canadian government would give me enough money to buy that amount of liquid helium. So this stuff has got viscosity. It's clearly got, it's not irrotational flow. And yet, we're still getting this beautiful thermal spectrum coming out of the thing. What this suggests is that this thermal spectrum really is an incredibly robust feature of any kind of system like this. When it was first discovered, I mean, everybody sort of thought, including me, that this thermal radiation was something that was really special to black holes, that it was a real peculiar feature of black holes that it would produce this thermal nature radiation. What's happened is that it doesn't, you know, it seems to be an extremely robust phenomenon, giving one an awful lot more confidence as well, that even though Hawking's original derivation had all those problems, it was probably right. That real black holes almost certainly do produce thermal radiation, because everything else does. Well, this one, everything else does. But, I mean, if you did other experiments, you could hope. Now, it would be really nice, of course, to do an experiment in which one would directly see the quantum thermal radiation coming out. We're not going to do it with water. You know, maybe flow of liquid helium through a nozzle. But that seems to have lots of problems with vorticity creation and so forth. People have suggested using optical fibers and sending strong pulses of light down the optical fiber in order to change the refractive index and produce what's effectively a black or a white hole horizon in that, and look for the quantum radiation given off of that. Bose-Einstein condensates have been suggested as a possible way of doing it, producing a little nozzle. The problem there, again, is that the temperature is like 10 to the minus 8 Kelvin. On the other hand, Bose-Einstein condensates tend to be of that temperature, unlike my water. So one could hope to see it. So there is a possibility one will directly be able to see the thermal radiation, the quantum thermal radiation from one of these analog black holes. Alternatively, of course, is to grab a small black hole somewhere and look at the radiation from it. But that's a little more dicey. Yes.
A key part of your argument is that linear amplifiers just have to introduce kind of noise.
Right.
Now, is there a succinct, simple way of seeing how much that has to be? Like, why it has to be and how much? Is there a simple way of seeing that? Is there some simple argument, one or two sentences of the kind that otherwise such and such would go wrong?
Sure. I mean, this was the Hausse and Mullen argument. The basic thing that goes wrong is that if you look at the commutation relations of X and P, so you start off with some X and P whose commutator is equal to 1. If you go on to the other side, you want to make sure that the X and P's commutator is also equal to 1 there. But by doing the amplification, there's this huge factor between the X and P over here and the X and P over here. And by looking at those commutation relations and then looking at the squares of them, you can derive that this linear amplifier has to produce noise. That's basically what I did here. I used ANA dagger instead of X and P. But remember, my ANA dagger had absolutely nothing to do with energy. You know, they weren't connected to the Hamiltonian.
I understand.
They were just the generic A's and A daggers that you can form from the X's and P's. So all of my derivation really was just looking at the commutation relations of X and P and deriving the fact that the linear amplifier has to produce noise.
But isn't that restricted to the case of the amplifier being described as a Bogoliubov transform acting on coherence?
No, the only kind of amplifier you can have, that's the only kind of amplifier that you can have. In order to have a phase insensitive amplifier, you basically have to have that Bogoliubov transformation.
Oh, I see.
Okay. So that is the generic model for a linear amplifier, is part of my argument.
But is it easy to see that this is the only way?
It's linear. What else can you do?
It's linear. More or less. And I mean, you can also do a phase-sensitive amplifier, which is one in which the A gets multiplied by something, and the A dagger gets, the X gets multiplied by something, and P gets divided by that same something. That gives you a phase-sensitive amplifier. X's get amplified, P's get de-amplified. Those also produce noise, but not the same character.
You see, my point is that if you want to draw the conclusion from the water experiment,
right.
You can then go back and say, well, the only way that, I mean, you have to be able to say that the only way, really, that this can be described is by going into this description there. So you have to have a uniqueness there.
Right. And I think we can do that. But I can't do it in two sentences here.
Maybe you can take a quick
question. Yeah, I just had a simple question about that data. There aren't really any error bars on it, so it looks like there's an oscillation about that linear fit. Is that real? Is that a function of the water?
No, I believe that's an indication of the errors in this kind of graph. One of the things that, it's really hard to figure out how to calculate the errors. One of the things that we did was to divide our data in half and measure, use half of the data and the other half of the data to see what kind of a fit we would get then. It made very little difference except in one or two of these points where it made sort of about that much difference. So this doesn't seem to be directly a statistical error. On the other hand, if you look back at these graphs, what we have to do is to basically separate out these peaks, right? So here we've got a peak here. Exactly where does that peak start and where are you picking up, you know, the broad tails of the incoming radiation. Okay?
So one other
point. And we've had, and two different people have done it, and for one of them we got a slope in that graph of about 9, and the other gave a slope of about 8. So they're definitely, you know, trying to decide which of these peaks are the right peaks for the positive and negative is one of the sources of errors.
So when the thing is all set up and going, how long does it take to complete?
To run that sequence of experiments took a day, basically. One of the interesting things, again, is that neither Silke Weinfurt nor I are experimentalists. We're both theorists. Ted Tedford and Greg Lawrence are experimentalists. But this was, you know, and Silke was really the one that was driving this experiment for most of the time. So this is an experiment being done largely by, you know, the physics is being done by theorists rather than by experimentalists. So that means it took a little bit longer.
So I'm asking, so do you foresee Hawking radiation in a first-year undergrad lab?
Well, this was, all of this experiment was done in a, I don't know, probably a second or third-year undergraduate civil engineering lab. And the techniques that we used, although, you know, this using the high-resolution camera, this is a, you know, 2,000 by 1,000 camera. We were taking 20 frames a second on this thing. So it's a high-speed black and white, because a color camera has worse resolution than a black and white camera does because of the filtering. So that was sort of one of the most expensive parts of the apparatus, other than paying postdocs. You know, and then putting
lab demonstrators are cheaper, or are they?
I'm not sure. The dye is also a little bit, very slightly not too good for you. So having undergraduates with a whole batch of water with the dye in it, you might be a bit worried about. The laser was a half a watt laser, and a half a watt green laser can be pretty dangerous. Although what we did was we spread out, I didn't emphasize in that picture, this is a laser came into a lens called the Powell lens, which spreads out the beam in one direction and leaves it very narrow in the other. So the width of this beam is about a millimeter or two, and the length of the width of the beam here, the length of the beam is about 2 meters. So that, of course, makes it safer if you happen to look into the thing, but it still probably is not something I'd advise anyone to do. Yeah, so this is probably the main thing that would keep it out of the undergraduate labs, having a half a watt laser running around.
So Neil's been asking.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, sorry. did you calculate this constant, the eight seconds?
Did we?
You've got a slope of 8 on your
curve. Yeah.
Can you relate that to the physical properties of the system?
We've tried to do that. It's really hard because it's not clear exactly where we should be doing that derivative, you know, derivative of c squared minus v squared. The blocking is occurring before the place where you would expect the horizon to form. Mm-hmm. Okay, it occurs early. So do you measure it there or do you measure it at the horizon? Furthermore, this flow has got, you know, is not irrotational, just in this region where you're doing the measurement. So all of these things make one really leery. But to within about 50% to get the same answer.
And what is it equal to? In the simplest theory, if you just assume irrotational flow, what is that constant given by in terms of the density of water and velocity?
No, it's just the velocity of the water, basically. The density of the water drops out. So it's the rate of change of the velocity with distance along.
That's a rate.
Yeah. So it seems to give roughly the right answer, but it's really hard to figure out.
If a graduate student came and told you about it, you'd say they wouldn't know what they were doing.
I'll leave that for others to come decide. Yes?
You said it happens every time we have an amplifier. How much Hawking radiation do we get from the amplifiers in our electronics?
Well, the thing about our electronics is that the two input channels, I said you need two input channels. The second input channel almost always is not in the vacuum state. It's got a lot of thermal noise in it. So most amplifiers produce lots of noise, which is thermal noise. But I mean, this quantum noise, for example, in the gravity wave detector business, they really are trying to get down to this quantum limit where their amplifiers are limited by the quantum noise, amplification, if you will, of the quantum fluctuations rather than the classical fluctuations. So, you know, that's one thing that, you know, people building really, really good amplifiers really do worry about. For most amplifiers, as I say, there's far, you know, as with the water system, you know, our water is far higher temperature than
than 0 Kelvin. So, you know, the noise in our system would be dominated by either thermal noise or, in fact, vibrational noise from the lab type of stuff. But every amplifier that we have, you know, including this one here, will, if you try and build it better and better, ultimately produce quantum noise that you won't be able to get down below.
But isn't, maybe Leo's asking a simpler question, if you have this two-state system, what you're essentially measuring is a sort of Bogle-Lyubov coefficient.
Right.
And can that not be done very simply with an electronic amplifier?
Sure, and people do that.
So did they get the straight line?
No. So there's two separate things here. One is if you take one of those channels and ask about it, what this analysis says is that channel produces some sort of thermal radiation. It doesn't say what is the amplitude of that radiation between the various channels. And the fact that radiation between the various channels also has the thermal form is what's peculiar about these horizons. So for an ordinary amplifier, that's not going to be true. I mean, what this says is that the amplification factor drops with frequency, with a very particular form, basically an exponential form.
You can't mimic that with an electronic system.
You could mimic it. You could presumably mimic it.
But it wouldn't be generic.
But yeah, it wouldn't be generic, and you'd have a hard time saying that this was anything to do with horizons and so forth.
Okay, so maybe one more question.
Is there a classical experiment that you could, in principle, do on a black hole to get the analogous determination of its Hawking temperature?
Yeah, so the problem in a black hole is, as I said, there the input channel has this frequency of e to the 10 to the fifth after 1 second of formation, okay? So what you would have to do is to send in radiation towards the black hole with frequencies of e to the 10 to the fifth, and then look at the stuff that comes out. You'd only see that one stuff because the other stuff went into the black hole. Look at the amplitude of the stuff that comes off of the black hole to find out how much the amplification is. Now, it's clearly not energy amplification. There's a massive energy de-amplification here. You've gone from e to the 10 to the fifth in energy to 1 in energy. That's, you know, you've lost energy like mad. But the amplitude given by the norm, that invariant norm that I mentioned, that amplitude has increased as it comes out of the black hole. So you could do a scattering experiment like that in principle for a black hole, but clearly it would be absurd because the stuff you're sending in has got more energy than the whole universe has in it. And its gravitational field would completely disrupt any experiment that you happen to be doing. So the answer is, in principle, yes, if one plays with a toy model. In practice, absolutely and totally not.
And that factor would have to be, I would need a microscopic black hole to make that factor reasonable?
No, I mean, even for a microscopic black hole, remember that factor grows as the time since the black hole formed. So this e to the 10 to the fifth was 1 second after the black hole, after a solar mass black hole formed. If I wait 10 seconds, it's e to the 10 to the sixth. If I wait 100 seconds, etc. So, you know, it basically becomes hopeless. You run into this whole Planck scale problem for doing the classical experiment with a black hole. The reason you can do that here is that because of the altered dispersion relationship, that high frequency is always limited. There's a cutoff to that high frequency. And so, you know, in our case, the high frequency, the wavelength coming out is about this long. You start off with wavelengths that are this long, and they come out as being that long. So instead of e to the 10 to the fifth, it's only a factor of, you know, between 10 and 100 that we've got. And that's what allows us to do the experiment. If it were 10 to the fifth or 10 to the sixth, it would be hopeless again. You get nonlinearities. The problem is that the waves coming in would pile up on the horizon, have such a huge amplitude that the whole system would go nonlinear, and then you wouldn't trust anything. That was one of our biggest questions, is to try and do this experiment, making sure that we were staying in the linear regime. So for example, we ran the experiment with twice the amplitude or 1.5 times the amplitude of the wave coming in to see whether the output scaled properly or whether, you know, if there were a nonlinearity, you might have the output doubling. You know, you feed in something and you get twice as much out. And we didn't see that. We saw, you know, the proper scaling. So we're pretty sure that we're seeing a linear phenomenon here.
Well, we should probably finish Phil's around for a few more weeks.
Yeah, until September 30th. So,
okay, so plenty of time to ask questions. Let's thank Phil for